What material, where does the material of the test stop being?
Chapter 5. Okay. 4 and 5.
Chapter 4 and 5. And is today chapter 5 or is today chapter?
Today is still chapter 5.
Okay.
So I think today is the last day that would be on the test. So the plan is, you know, plans change, but the plan is that Wednesday would be talking about magnetic fields, which existed as problems in chapter 4, but not in text, so they wouldn't be on the exam. But I wonder if the arm isn't going to be twisted to move that exam. But if there's no one here, there's no one to twist it.
I would potentially twist that arm.
Well, arm wrestling between two is pretty easy. It's not necessarily going to win. It's when four gang up on one.
I can drum up support.
Well, we'll see. Right now, there isn't a lot of support.
Yeah, okay. Honestly, either day is equally bad.
Either day is equally bad. So what else is happening? Why is
I had a concert this weekend, so I had like 3 to 4 hour dress rehearsal on Saturday, then a 2 hour concert with like 2 hours beforehand also. So it was pretty much like nothing happened academically.
Yeah, but so yeah, I don't know. So that's last weekend, right?
Yeah, so I didn't get so this weekend there's another.
Oh, so it's a repeat?
No, it's a different concert.
Different concert. Okay. So more dress rehearsals and all of that.
No, it should be too much of a problem. It's far less of a problem.
So last time we were talking about few particle systems. And actually today the plan is to talk about many particle systems, kind of generally. And our starting point was the helium atom. If we look at the ground state of helium, we're going to put, of course, both electrons in the lowest available energy state. Since that's going to be symmetric, we have to couple it with an anti-symmetric spin state, so we lead to a singlet s ground state. If we look at the excited states, it's slightly more interesting. We could leave one electron in the ground state and put the other electron in the 2s state, which based on the kind of qualitative features we've been thinking about in terms of electron cloud shielding, the 2s state, we guess, is going to have a lower energy than the 2p state. But if we just go and kind of naively calculate the expectation value of the energy for these states, we do in fact find this sort of ordering, that the triplet state is going to have the lowest energy, and we explain that in terms of the fact that with this minus sign, R1 equals R2, that is to say, if we ask what's the probability that the electrons are on top of each other, is zero, so we minimize the amount of interaction. And that's the first of Hund's rules, that the largest value of S is going to have the largest amount of spin symmetry and hence the largest amount of spatial anti-symmetry and hence minimize the amount of electron-electron interaction. And we also see for both of these cases that the P state lies above the corresponding S state, matching kind of what we think about the L tilt for the electron levels. So if we look at increasingly complicated atoms, it's more and more difficult to do even simple calculations with them. So we start closing our eyes and just doing kind of the simplest possible thing, fill up the electron energy, the L-tilted electron energy levels, so the S levels fill up before the P levels, which fill up before the D levels, and sometimes the D level is pushed above the next level S state, so we lead to this sort of periodic table where we have two equivalent columns here because it's an S state, so we can put in two electrons, spin up or spin down. We've got six states here that correspond to L equals one, so we have three degenerate states for the P states, and we can put two electrons in each one of them, so we get six levels here. For the D states, L is two, so we have 2L plus one or five states, which means we're gonna have 10 cases here. This is the F state, which is L equals three. So that's going to lead to seven possibilities or 14 elements that are in this bottom row. And we see that in fact that the filling of the D level is delayed. So before we fill up the N equals three D level, we fill in the 4S level. Okay, so that kind of crude statement about what's going on in the periodic table called configuration, we want to do better than that in terms of actually figuring out the levels that are involved. That is to say, how are these states, you know, given that we have, for example, two P states in carbon, how are those two P states related? How are the angular momentums all coupled together? And there are kind of two simple situations. The simplest situation is just to use this table, which shows how the angular momentums can be arranged for equivalent and non-equivalent electrons. So in terms of, for example, two equivalent electron states, what this thing says is that we could make triplet S and triplet P and singlet D and S. And that particular case is something that we can derive pretty simply just using the rules of angular momentum. So if we have P states, we're adding angular momentum 1 to 1. So we know we can get everything between 2 and 0. These things start symmetric and then oscillate on their way down. If we're adding spin 1 half to spin 1 half, as we have to, if we have two electrons, we've got the triplet state, which is symmetric, and the singlet state, which is antisymmetric, and then it's just a matter of mixing and matching, because we have to have an overall antisymmetric state. So if we're going to have a low-energy triplet state, we're going to have to match it with a P state so that the overall spin reflection symmetry, overall particle exchange symmetry is negative. With the singlet states, we can match them with the D or the S states, and we get exactly the set of states that are listed in that table. Similarly, for adding two D electrons, we work that out, and in terms of the triplet states, there's a P and an F, and in terms of the singlet states, there are S, D, and G states, and according to Hund's rules, the lowest energy state is going to have the maximum value of spin, which is triplet, the maximum value of L, which is F, and the smallest value of J. And if we're adding spin, if we're adding angular momentum 3 to angular momentum 1, we can get for J values everything between 4 and 2, and the lowest energy state for this less than half filled level is going to be the minimum value of J. So the ground state of this guy, titanium, which has 2D electrons, should be triplet F2. Questions? So we can play this game. We're talking here about building up atoms, but we can play this game for nuclei, where we're building up nuclei out of neutrons and protons, various states. We can talk about it building up baryons, where we're adding quark states. It all works the same. Historically, of course, it all started with atoms, and that's pretty much what we're going to be talking about in the future, how we get some of these details out of atomic structure. But I wanted to spend at least some time on the reverse possibility. So instead of looking at a handful of particles, we might have 10 to the 23rd particles. And in particular, we might have translational symmetry. So you can't literally have translational symmetry because every crystal is a finite size, but if we have billions of lattice spacings that are all the same, it's going to approximate translational symmetry. So even a microscopically sized crystal has zillions of repeats of the same structure, and so close enough, it's going to have translational symmetry. And kind of the very junior version of this is to think about something like copper as being a gas of electrons non-interacting, moving through the lattice of nuclei. I say nuclei, but it would include the core electrons in this, because we're only going to have the valence electrons running around freely. And, we've done this problem. So if we have some big hunk of material, if we solve Schrodinger's equation, we're going to end up with terms like this, where we have to have standing waves in x, y, and z directions. And basically, if we ignore the real and imaginary parts, this is basically e to the I k dot r, where k is just made up out of these pieces. Right, where Lx, Ly, Lz are the size of the solids. And the energy of this state just depends on the k squared. And we talked about this in terms of sometimes called k space. So if I just put a dot for every possible state, they're going to fill in a lattice. Right, so I'm going to have some sort of lattice of possible states. It's not necessarily going to be a square lattice unless Lx equals Ly equals Lz. And it really can't depend on the shape of the piece of metal. But so assuming square would be fine, but just to leave things general. Right, so every dot corresponds to producing one of these k vectors. And the energy just depends on k squared. So if we have 12 electrons we're going to put into this system, we're going to put them into the lowest energy state, which is to say the state that is closest to the origin, right? That has the smallest value of k squared. Right? So we can put in 2 electrons here, 2 electrons here, 2 electrons there, 2 electrons there, maybe 2 electrons there. We need one more set. I don't know. So we want the smallest possible value of k squared. So I guess this is the last electron that we're going to put in. And clearly, if we have 10 to the 23rd electrons that we're going to put in, we're going to end up with some, and of course, really this thing is in three dimensions, we're going to end up with some relatively large k vector. And all of the states inside of that k vector are going to be filled, and all of them outside of that k vector are going to be empty. So this surface that defines the difference between whether a state is occupied or unoccupied, that's called the Fermi surface. And since it's usually a sphere, sometimes it's called the Fermi sphere. Although in real materials, as opposed to theoretical materials, it doesn't have to have a spherical shape. It can have a very convoluted shape, writing out what the energy is in terms of the corresponding k vectors. Okay, so far I don't think there's anything much new about this. So this kind of model of solids, of conducting solids, was started by Drude before quantum mechanics became understood, and it doesn't work, at least in the context of classical mechanics. So one of the things that I'm sure you were told in 211, but it's been a while, is that for every quadratic degree of freedom, the average energy in that degree of freedom is 1/2 kT. Right? So this had to do with the specific heat of gases. If it could only translate, then it was 3/2 kT. If it could vibrate, then we added another, etc. So just from the nuclei, they can vibrate, and it's kind of like an isotropic simple harmonic oscillator. So we should expect a specific heat that is something like 6R. But then these electrons should add to that. If they're like the atoms in this room, they can move faster or slower. There are other things that point out problems, and that is, you know, I mean, the electrons are moving through this solid. Why don't they get banged into? Why isn't there a lot of scattering? Why is the mean free path so relatively big? So these things are resolved by thinking about how quantum mechanics works and how quantum statistical mechanics works. So it turns out, if we look at the probability of these states being occupied versus energy, what we've just said is that they're 100% occupied until they're not occupied. Right? Everything inside of the Fermi energy is occupied. Everything outside of the Fermi energy is unoccupied. Well, if we add finite temperature to the system, then there's going to be some chance that this electron here has enough energy to be raised a little bit above the Fermi energy. And the occupation fraction that we get stays pretty much one until we reach the vicinity of the Fermi energy. That is to say, the only things that actually are rearrangeable are within kT of the Fermi energy, because that's the only extra energy that's available. So, I don't know, to kind of put numbers on this, not uncommonly Fermi energies would be on the order of or even more than 1 eV, and at room temperature, kT is about 1/40 of an electron volt. So the vast majority of the electrons are not close enough to this Fermi surface to have their energy change substantially. And something similar goes on in terms of scattering. So if we have all of these states filled, let's say you bang on a hammer on that particular electron, what can it do? Well, it can't change a little bit because all of the available levels are near it. So it's going to keep being what it is unless you bang on it hard enough to push it out to an unoccupied level. Right? There's no place for it to go to. So minor nicks and bruises on that particular electron can't change it at all, because there's no place for it to go. So only relatively big bumps or small bumps to electrons that are close to the Fermi surface, those are the only things that can in fact be affected. So you'll talk in much greater detail about all of this next semester. Let me just write down at least the formula for the occupation rate. So this mu is called the chemical potential. Basically the same thing as the Fermi energy. So if we have a, if KT is only a 40th and we move slightly off that energy, if the energy is less than the chemical potential, then we have a negative number here. We have a negative, we have e to the minus 40 then, so the occupation number is going to be basically 1. On the other hand, if we're a little bit above, so that e minus mu is positive, then we're going to have e to the plus 40, which is basically 0. So the only region where this occupation number is not either 0 or 1 is in a relatively small range where e minus mu is on the order of kT, because then we only get e to the 1, so we get an occupation number that's, you know, only 1 over e plus 1, as opposed to being, you know, 1 over 20,000 or 1 plus a very small number. Okay, so that's how it works with fermions. For bosons, turns out there's just a minus sign there. And that leads to radically different behavior. That is to say, fermions don't want to be in the same energy level. Bosons like to be in the same energy level. And we have phenomena, for example, like the Bose condensation, where all of the particles are in the lowest available energy state. Right? Everyone can be in that state because they're not fermions. They're bosons. And a lot of odd properties like superfluidity, superconductivity, are related to this Bose condensation. Okay, so Fermi surface, Fermi sphere. The only active states are the ones that are relatively close to the surface of the Fermi that are relatively close to the Fermi energy. And so only those are going to have a noticeable contribution to the specific heat, which explains why the specific heat of a conductor and a specific heat of a non-conductor are both about 6R. Only the nuclear vibrations contributing to the energy. Okay. So the rest of the plan is kind of to go through the online stuff in an annotated way and see how we can build up more complicated pictures of solids than this idea of a free electron gas. So if we start to think about building up molecules point by point, kind of the first thing we might want to think about is the H2 plus ion, where I have two nuclei and one electron that's orbiting around them. And it turns out this is actually an exactly solvable problem, kind of surprisingly. It's a huge ugly mess. But you can actually write down the wave functions for this case. And I take it it's kind of no surprise that the ground state wave function is, you know, kind of going to be smeared all over those two particles. In terms of excited states, we have kind of two options. We can give the electrons, the single electron, angular momentum around the coordinate that connects the two particles. We call that the z-coordinate. Or we can start building up nodes. So here there might be a node right between these two particles. So we label these states with the angular momentum in the z-axis using capital Greek letters. So sigma is going to mean no angular momentum in the z-axis, like S. Pi is going to be like P. It's going to be 1 unit of angular momentum around that axis. Delta, etc. And we can label these states, at least start to label them, with the Greek, with the German words gerade and ungerade. According to whether they are symmetric or antisymmetric about the midpoint between the two molecules. Okay, but this is obviously, well, I mean, we could spend a week and we could do these sorts of calculations, but we really need a simpler model if we're going to make, you know, some sort of reasonable progress on it. And the simpler model is going to be to replace the nuclei with delta functions, right? Because we can solve the problem of delta functions. And we can kind of see how this is going to work, at least qualitatively, if we have multiple particles. And I mean, the mathematics is online, but, you know, kind of no surprise, here's what we have. We have a symmetric state like this. So the delta functions are, I guess, are at I don't know, it says 4, but boy, that doesn't, oh, I see, the separation is 4. So the delta functions are at 2 and minus 2. Here we have a symmetric state, and here we have an antisymmetric state. And kind of no surprise, the symmetric state is going to have the lower energy than the antisymmetric state. And one of the things that people would draw attention to is a state like this, we are building up negative charge between these two nuclei. So these two nuclei can be held together by this cloud of negative charge that sits between them. So orbits like this, where we build up charge between the nuclei, would be called bonding orbits. Cases like this, where we're not building up much charge between the nuclei, would be called antibonding orbits. It turns out that if we try and shove these nuclei too close together, so here's a plot of in terms of inverse A, so this is where they're close together and here's where they're far apart, then what happens is these two levels, which start out to be pretty much degenerate, are going to diverge until we only have this one symmetric state. Okay, basically what happens is if you try and push them too close together, there's a whole lot of energy in going between one state, between going from a positive value to a negative value in a limited region, right? You're going to have a big slope. Slope corresponds to kinetic energy. So we lose that state as a negative energy state. So, I mean, we're not going to go there, but you can think about kind of similar things for the hydrogen atom. If we have separate hydrogen atoms, then we have this molecule. If we actually bring the nuclei together, then we've got a helium nuclei. And they're both kind of solvable problems. So if we have a unified atom, we're going to have these sets of states. Notice the L tilting. If we have separate atoms, then we're going to have separate 1s states. And at great distances between these two, we're just going to separate these into symmetric and antisymmetric states that have pretty much the same energy, just as the delta functions had pretty much the same energy when they had big separation. So remember that close to the origin is a big separation, far from the origin is a small separation. So we can kind of classify how these states match up as we think about changing the separation. So this anti-bonding state, which is made up out of two 1s levels, if we follow through what that becomes when we push the atoms together to make a helium nuclei, it turns out to be the same as this antisymmetric combination of two P's. Okay, so kind of the overall story is when we combine things, things are going to go up, things are going to go down. These two P states are going to combine to make symmetric and antisymmetric combinations of the corresponding P levels. Okay, so here is an actual H2 neutral atom. The ground state, kind of no surprise, singlet. It's going to have no angular momentum about the axis. It's going to be grata. And what we have here is actually a combination of two things called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. If we think about the electrons, they have very high speed motion. And the nuclei are kind of going to be vibrating and the electrons almost instantaneously responding to them. So if we calculate what the energy is of the system at different radii, that will be the potential for the vibration of the two nuclei. So here are the vibrational levels, simple harmonic levels, that we have for the nuclei from the lowest vibrational state up to vibration state of 10. And what it says is that the vibration state of 14 actually would break the two nuclei apart. That would lead to dissociation. All right, so here we have an ungarata state. Here's a transition that goes from the ground state up to this state, which then can lead to dissociation. Energy levels measured in EV, kind of typical sorts of numbers, sizes measured in angstroms, typical for atoms. Okay, so we're actually building up towards solids. So 2 isn't a very good approximation to 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So what if we bring in more nuclei? So here we have 3 nuclei. We're going to build up with 3 levels. Again, we're going to lose these levels if we bring them too close together. When they're moderately far apart, they have pretty much the same energy. All right, so we can add more and more particle states. As we add states, you can see they get kind of clumped together. So I think here is 32 states, so there should be 32 energy levels here. And you might notice you can start to kind of talk about the density of states. That is to say, here the states are more closely packed than they are here. And we just want to increase this number from 32 to, 6 times 10 to the 23rd. And it's kind of surprising. I don't know if it's surprising or not, what these things look like in terms of their states. So the ground state is kind of a superposition of all of the delta functions for all of the nuclei. And then we start building up a wave of a wavelength that is longer than the separation between the particles. And so you can kind of see these waves built up until we reach something that is basically the antisymmetric state. Okay, so this sort of idea of molecular orbits, where the ground state of the system, the wave function actually spans the entire molecule, chemists have kind of a problem with that. They like to think of electrons as being connected to individual atoms, but they're really not. They really are distributed all over the molecule. So there's one case where the chemists do allow themselves to think about the fact that these wave functions spread all over, and that's what they call resonance. And kind of the typical example of this is the benzene ring, where there simply isn't. So just as you can induce a current in a wire loop by changing the magnetic field, you can very demonstrably produce a current that's going around in a benzene ring by putting it in a changing magnetic field. You can measure that phenomena. So there's no doubt that the electrons even the chemists are convinced that the The electrons in the benzene ring are free to roam around. But it has to be true of all molecules. And I don't know, that leads to kind of problems. Because, you know, the chemists aren't stupid. They have this idea that the electrons are bound to particular spots because it seems to match their experiments. If they knock an electron out, they're liable to have a chemical reaction right in that vicinity, not 12 atoms over. Where we would say, you know, that electron is pretty much every place. So, you know, what's going on? How can we have this kind of localized behavior seen by chemists, whereas the physics says that the wave functions are in fact distributed all over? And the answer to this sort of question is to think about, there's lots of mathematics here which we're not going through. Maybe I'll come back to this in a second, but so, you know, we can play the game of time dependence. So if I can take some function and I can write it in terms of these wave functions, and I can figure out what these coefficients are with Fourier's trick, then the time dependence of the wave function, I just tack on the time dependence of each individual one. So if I play that game, and I think about putting an electron on one of these atoms, what does its motion actually look like? And it looks, I don't know, pretty much like what you would think. It, you know, goes to one end of the molecule and bounces back. But it takes it some time. And it turns out you can correlate the time it takes for this hopping behavior to how wide that band is. So remember, we saw that the energy levels were all concentrated into a region around a half. If I get the molecules more separated, the delta functions more separated, then that bandwidth decreases, and this hopping frequency takes longer. So to the extent that atoms are widely separated, this hopping frequency would be long compared to the chemical reaction time. Okay, so the bandwidth correlates to this hopping frequency. And as long as that hopping frequency is slow compared to chemical reactions, then chemists can happily think that the electron is in one spot. It doesn't have time to move way down. And do understand that just as there's a huge difference between the velocity of sound in a material and the velocity of the atoms that make it up, those electrons are actually moving on the order of 10%, on the order of 1% of the speed of light. But this hopping frequency is a much slower velocity. Right? Just because the electrons are moving fast doesn't mean the electron wave has to move fast. The combination of all of them, which depends on the energy differences, not on the actual energies. Okay, so I don't know if we want to go back to, well, yeah, I think that, well, here's kind of the overall band structure that we have. So far we've only been talking about the bound states, but there are going to be unbound states too. So I've now made a distinction that is that I guess I'm washing over. I've now actually gone to an infinite number of particles. That's what this mathematics is about. So I'm using translational symmetry, and under these circumstances, I'm going to have these states that are basically the bound sort of states we've been talking about that have energy that's about a half. And I also have these other states that, I have positive energy, so you might think about them as being kind of like free states. And as we go from one end of this band to the other end of this band, the wave function isn't changing as much as you would think. Okay, so here's the hopping. So if we go back to a finite-sized crystal, we can go back and ask the sort of questions we did about these sort of free states, right? I can have a particle that's coming in with some kinetic energy, and it's going to interact with this sequence of delta functions. We can ask for the reflection probability, the transmission probability. And of course, the mathematics of it comes moderately complicated, but the upshot is relatively easy to understand. So here we have the results that we had for an actually infinite number of atoms. And here we have a reflection calculation based on, I guess, 32 atoms. Right? So 32, again, maybe doesn't seem like a good approximation to infinity. But notice that where we have band gaps, so this is a case where there is no state that has this energy, the upshot is that you get 100% reflection from those states. So a free electron can happily go flying in if there's an available state. But there, if there isn't a state that has that energy, it's going to be reflected out. And we can actually measure these sorts of properties with metals, right? So people who are interested in the behavior of metals can shine electrons in, and by looking at what's reflected back, they can learn what these internal levels are. I think that's the end of that. Oops. So everything's in one dimension, which means that it's a whole lot simpler than we start doing things in multiple dimensions. And the easy thing to do is to kind of start slowly at this, to look at a two-dimensional case. So the case that's, and this is all going to be kind of, we can't solve these problems exactly, so there's all going to be kind of Mathematica calculation. So what we have here is a lattice of circles that are kind of hexangular closest packed. So we have this repeat vector A, and we have this repeat vector B, and we can generate this lattice by moving any number of points between A and B. Inside of each one of those circles, I'm going to have a potential that is quadratic, right? So it's kind of simple harmonic oscillator inside of those circles. And in the region between these circles, the potential is going to be zero. You might notice that there are several ways we can think about this lattice. We can think about it in terms of these sort of rhombuses, or we can think about it in terms of these hexagons. Either one of those is just as good for generating the whole structure. Yeah, it might be worth commenting that you can actually make these sorts of two-electron gases. So kind of the big gun for translational symmetry is known in physics as Bloch's theorem. It was actually done first by astronomer Hill in the context of classical mechanics. The mathematicians know this as Floquet's theorem. Bloch is the guy who did this in terms of quantum mechanics. And what Bloch's theorem says is if we have a potential that is periodic, then I can guarantee you that the wave function can be written in the following form. A function that is exactly periodic times one of these things that's e to the ikr. And if you think about kind of what those finite crystal wave functions look like, they had little delta function wave functions on top of every nuclei, but there was an overall sine wave that was connecting them all together. And that's kind of what's going on here. This is the overall sine wave, except it's phase, and here's the overall potential. And this is exactly periodic, and the fact that this is just a phase says that the electron density is going to be the same at every equivalent spot, right? Because if I take the absolute magnitude of this square, this is going to give me 1. So I have exactly the same periodic function in terms of electron energy density every place, but I have this overall wave behavior at much larger distances. So this K is sometimes called reciprocal lattice space or crystal momentum. And it's going to play the role of momentum pretty much under all sorts of circumstances. Now there's a detail that makes things more complicated. And well, so first of all, we have a detail of how you write periodic functions. And what we need, it turns out, are vectors that are perpendicular to these vectors, so that when they dot, they give zero. So I'm going to create a vector called A dagger that is perpendicular to B, and I'm going to create a vector called B dagger that is perpendicular to A. And using linear combinations of those guys, I can make functions that have waves like that, right? So if I make a wave that's in the A dagger direction, it's going to make a wave that's along these planes. If I make a wave that's in the B direction, it's going to be going that way. So I can make nicely periodic waves. Now, remember the overall game is to have e to the I k dot r times a function that is periodic. But this function here, if I look at a k vector, it'll be periodic itself as long as it's on one of these lattices. So the upshot is if k gets bigger than a lattice spacing, then you can reduce it down in size and plonk the periodic piece of it into U. So we don't have to think about the k vector as being infinite. We can restrict it to some finite size called the Brillouin zone, and anything else would be automatically included. Okay, so there's one thing that I hope is reasonably clear, and there's one thing that's maybe not so reasonably clear. If we have a periodic function, then I can take off cycles of that period, and it's just as periodic with respect to that one. So that's kind of what I'm doing, is I'm taking off pieces that are already periodic. Instead of putting them into the e to the I k r piece, I'm putting them in the u piece. So the other thing that's maybe not so clear is we've got two things that are periodic. We've got the physical lattice that has the A and B vectors as periodicities, and we have the Fourier transform of that based on these A daggers and B dagger vectors that is also periodic. Okay, so there are two lattices. There's a lattice in Fourier transform space, and there's a lattice in physical space. And really what we're talking about here is a lattice in Fourier transform space. So we don't have to think about k as being infinite. We can cut it down to this region of one Brillouin zone, and that contains all the information we need to have about it. So I don't know. So this is the mathematics of kind of solving these problems. So the first thing to solve is actually a free particle. Right? A free particle certainly has a periodic potential, right? Zero every place, so it's periodic. And we can use all of this complicated mathematics in order to solve that sort of problem. And we know that, in fact, the energy just goes like a free particle, right? It's h bar squared over 2mk squared. And when we compress that to these Brillouin zones, the fact that it's k squared gets folded back on itself to make these kind of complicated set of bands. Well, so there's a problem of display. How do we, even in two dimensions, how do we display what the energy is as a function of this two-dimensional k vectors? And one way of doing it might be to make kind of a three-dimensional graph. Why is this not happy? There we go. To kind of make a three-dimensional graph of what the energy is on top of this k space. But even if we did that, we couldn't do that in three dimensions. So instead, what people typically do is they plot what the energy is on some sort of highly symmetrical path. So that's what this is. If we plot, so starting here at this large value of kx, if I plot what the energy is, here I'm at the origin, now I'm going up here, and here I'm going over to the side. These pieces, if you think about folding it together like origami, with a little bit of help, let you visualize what these energy surfaces look like, right? So they really look like this in three dimensions, but we're trying to visualize them with just a two-dimensional graph. Okay, so lots of mathematics. So some things to kind of pay attention to are the bandwidth. And you remember that the bandwidth tells you what the hopping frequency is. And if we have a very small bandwidth, then we have atoms that effectively are hanging on to those electrons, where the hopping frequency is slow compared to other sorts of processes. And we also have the existence of various gaps, energies at which there is no corresponding energy level. And the existence of band gaps is critical for distinguishing between insulators and conductors. In a conductor, there have to be some energy levels right near the Fermi level for the electron to go into in order to conduct electricity. If the energy level is filled right to the top, then it would take a big amount of energy to get that electron free to move. So in insulators, the lowest energy band is filled right to the top, and it takes a lot of energy in order to excite that electron to a region where it could actually move around. In conductors, the band is half filled, or at least partially filled, so they're right adjacent energy states that the electron can go into in order to conduct electricity. Well, so this shows what happens as a function of increasing the strength of these potentials. And at very strong potentials, you notice that you get very narrow bands, which corresponds to the electrons basically being bound into one of these levels, or at least, as I said, the hopping frequency being so slow that if you knocked one of these electrons out, it would be a while before the hole propagated any particular distance. So this is kind of showing what the wave functions look like. And of course, in the absence of any potential, these are just waves, right? Just e to the ikx waves. And so we have those sorts of waves present for these various values of k. But as we start to increase the value of the potential, we start getting things that look more like localized particles. Right? So looks like this electron is just staying right in the center of this well, and this is some sort of excitation of that. Okay, so you can kind of keep in your mind two things at once: the fact that these wave functions actually extend all the way to infinity, and that in the case of tight binding, case of small bandwidth, in fact, the electron isn't going to go very far. Even though the wave function goes all over the crystal, knocking one of these things out is not going to cause any electron is not going to be found far from where it's knocked out in a reasonable period of time. Okay, so that's kind of the alternative. We could talk about crystal structure, and we could talk about, in some sense, it's the single most important discovery of the 20th century, right? Transistors are the basis of our electronic technology. And understanding them is based on an understanding of the quantum mechanics of the underlying electronic motions. And we could, so the plan is in the future, we've solved kind of, well, I can't say we've solved all of the solvable problems, but there's a pretty small set of solvable problems like the H atom, where we can write down what the wave functions are. So if we want to do something interesting, we have to have some sort of approximation methods. So chapter 6 starts building out approximation methods. And we could apply these approximation methods to crystals, or we could apply these approximation methods to small groups of atoms, small groups of particles like atoms or nuclei or, in relativistic sense, particles. But historically, it was done first in atoms, and it seems a little bit simpler to do it in atoms than to bring up all of these complications of translational symmetries. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to be talking about approximating these systems that have fewish sort of particles. Questions? So, exam Friday? We talked about that at the beginning of class, and no one had any strong objections to doing it on Friday. I'm kidding.